Good morning.
How's everyone doing?
Hi.
Yeah, this time slot's a little snowy. I will agree. I see the numbers are fewer, but still. That's true. That's a good point. So, how did assignment one go? It'll be, give it a little time to mark, you know, for it to be marked, give it a little, but we'll put up solutions soon and we can talk about the answers and stuff. I don't think the first assignment should have been too bad, although I know the last question was a little open-ended. That was on purpose. And we can, rather than just focus on that question now, I'm going to put up a solution and then I think it'll kind of come out more as we go on to the material. So just as a heads up, next week I am not here. Class will be being held. Your TAs, Annie and Michael, will be lecturing on scheduling. So that's the next couple of chapters in the book. So please do come. Please do pay attention to them. They'll do a great job. I will be at the New Security Paradigms Workshop, so off in Victoria. So that's, if you ever want to look at computer security papers, NSPW is an interesting place to start because the papers are probably the craziest you will find in the literature. Some of them are outright strange. I'll just say that. I can try explaining, but it's better for you to look at it. Maybe I have a warped perspective because this is what I do, but some of it's actually kind of weird. Things like password managers without passwords. What does that mean? Anyway, today I want to talk more about processes. Specifically, I'm going to be talking about the process API. In preparation for this class, I looked again at the Windows Process API and it reminded me why I do not want to teach the Process API on Windows. It's there. The main function you should look up if you're curious, which I think I'm going to have you do in the lab there. Maybe not, but it's called Create Process. And it takes like 6 arguments, and yeah, it's just kind of complicated. And no, I'm not going to talk more about it. So show it to you in a tutorial. The key problem with Windows as an API is that it is highly non-orthogonal, which means that if you want to do something, there's not one way to do it. There might be 5 ways to do it. Now, can all of them do exactly the same thing? No. But they often have significant amounts of overlap. For example, there is this concept of links, of symbolic links. And hard links in Unix file systems we'll talk about. So in Unix, there's symbolic link and there's hard links. In Windows, there are about 5 different versions of links. And some of them work on some versions of Windows, and other of them work with other versions of Windows, and some of them have certain semantics, other semantics, and it's sometimes it's a complete mess. It's like, what happened there? Well, what happened was is they first introduced one API, and that API turned out to be pretty bad, so with limited functionality. So they introduced another API, but they had programs depending on the old API, so they had to keep the old one and add the new one. And they realized, wait, we didn't have all the functionality we wanted in that one, so we'll make another API. And this kept happening over the evolution of Windows. And so you look at their API and it's just a mess. Now, I'm not saying that Unix doesn't have its messy bits. It definitely does. If you ever look up the IOCTL system call in Unix and Linux systems, it's an abomination. And the reason why it's an abomination is because it doesn't have any well-defined semantics. What it stands for is I/O control. And I/O control means you give it a number of a device, and then you give it some arguments, and it varies from device to device what it does. It's a catch-all. It has no coherence. It's something that you figure out what the figure command is you need for it, and you wrap it in something else because it has no meaning. But in Unix, that is the exception. Most of the base stuff is actually pretty clean. And it's because the people working in the early 70s at Bell Labs who created this stuff were really smart guys, and they created the system that they wanted for themselves. They didn't create something to satisfy any sort of market. They didn't do it on behalf of anyone else. They did it on behalf of themselves. Left themselves, they made something that was pretty powerful. With quirks, but pretty powerful. So as I mentioned last time, when you create a process in Unix, you don't call one call. You have two calls. And actually, to really consider the full process API, there's really three or four calls. Anyway, so fork, first talk about these two. This has three arguments. Fork has no arguments. Now, if every time you wanted to, if the main use case for things were always these two being called together, you always did them both, then you'd say, wait, Windows approach makes a lot more sense. Why am I making two calls when I could have just made one call? Reason why these are split up is because there are distinct use cases for these individually. The question is, what are the use cases? So, let's talk a bit about what fork is, and then we'll talk about what you can do with it just on its own. If you don't consider anything about execve. And then we'll talk about execve. We'll see how it fits into that picture. So the classic structure you'll see of how you use fork. Now, this should at first glance go like, okay, it's a fork call inside of an if else statement. So, no arguments. Clearly, I'm making use of the return value of fork. So the question is, what does fork return? Obviously, fork returns different things. So what does it return?
I was going to say truth value.
It returns a truth value. Yeah. Well,
a number.
Kind of.
Process ID.
In part. It returns two distinct values. Every call, so no, this is the weird part. Every call to fork returns two values. Yeah, that's, well, it is process ID and zero. And in fact, fork always returns process ID and zero. every time you call it. Now you should go, wait a second, I called it once. You're telling me it returns two values? So what this is saying is, so when you run this here, you have one process. After this fork call, you have two processes running exactly the same code. You have two copies of your, you have the exact same executable running in two processes. What is in their memory? Exactly the same thing. What's the state of all their variables? Exactly the same. What files are open? Exactly the same files. It's exactly the same process. So, but you got two of them. Now, if you, yeah.
I was going to ask, is it like in the middle of its code, or is it like starting at the top, like going down?
It's exactly the same at this point of execution. When you complete fork, what you're doing is you've just gotten the return result. And that's why you always see a fork inside of a conditional. That's because two parts, right, two distinct processes are now running, the parent and the child. So logically, there's the original process, and then there's the new process. The new process is the child. The original process is the parent. They have exactly the same memory state, except for one difference. And the difference is, normally the way you do this, you do you assign the return result to PID. So if this is true, that means that PID is a non-zero value. That's a truthy value in C. So this is the code that is run in the parent. You're here, fork returns zero. It was false. Which means that now we are in the child.
What? Are there other equal signs for PID?
No. It's one equal sign. This is an assignment.
Oh, an assignment? Oh.
Wait, so no, I see. In PID.
Oh.
PID, the variable, I'm assigning the return value of fork to PID, which implies I want the return, I want that number. Now, if I'm in the child, it's zero. Big deal. PID zero is not particularly useful. Who cares? I don't use the value. Here, PID is non-zero. PID is the process identifier, the PID of the child. So you have two distinct processes. One is the parent, one is the child. You're now going to be running exactly the same code. And the child will be executing the code here. Parent will be executing the code here. You have to do something. If they're going to be doing very different things, you have to take care of it using this conditional. Otherwise, they'd be doing exactly the same code. Yes, this if is just you call fork, you get the return value, you assign the PID, and then you check what it is. That's standard C. By the way, Unix was co-developed with the C programming language. The C programming language was developed to implement C. So a lot of the things you'll see in this class when I start showing bits of the API and other things, you go like, wow, that looks like just like C code. Well, When you do things in C, you tend to do it in a Unix way because the standard APIs that were developed for C were all originally Unix. For Unix, most operating systems were built in assembly language. The problem with building operating systems in assembly language is what happens when someone comes out with a new computer, with a new processor or something? You have to rewrite the entire thing. It's written in C, you can port it. So they specifically implemented Unix in C to make it portable. That's one of the reasons why Unix became so portable, it became so popular, was because its source code was freely available and it was easily ported to new computers. Nowadays, we don't have many CPU architectures, but it used to be every time a new computer would come out, it would have a new CPU architecture. So this portability mattered a lot more than it did, but it still matters. So you run this, parents here, child is here, you're doing something. So to understand this parent-child thing, it's like, first off, the metaphor implies a certain level of connection and obligation. You got a parent and a child, they're not just two random things, they have some relationship. So, what is that relationship? So, on a Unix system, processes are arranged in a hierarchy. Every process has a number, every process has a parent. Any process can have any number of children. I think there are system specific limits, but. So what are these processes? So the top of the hierarchy is always process 1. And then this would be 2, maybe 3, and then maybe 4, 5, 6, 7, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So whenever you see a process identifier of like 2736, it means it's this 2736 process that was created on the system. Now, the really funny bit is that process IDs are only 16 bits compared to Unix systems. So there's only 65536 processes, I think. So there's what happens when you get above that? It wraps right back around. Using unused ones. So are there systems that need more than that process ID number? Yes. And there are various ways to do it, but standard Linux systems, process ID, it's. But anyway, so you have this hierarchy things. So if I'm talking about process 6, who's the parent of process 6? Process 5. Does the process 6 have any children? No. Process 4 has a child here, 11. 11 has no children. This is a hierarchy. All well and good. But what happens to this tree when the process terminates? The tree always has to be there. Every process always has to have a parent. So what happens if process 5 exits? It's gone. I've broken the tree.
It becomes the child
always of what? It always goes to the top. No matter how deep this is, it doesn't go to the parent or whatever. It always goes to process ID 1. Process ID 1 is known as init. Init, as in initial, as in the first. That is the process that is run first on a system, and it is the last process to terminate when the system shuts down or reboots.
So what would happen if you were to kill the init process?
So if process 1 exits, the system shuts down. You're done. So that process better not just die. It better not have like bugs in it. So, and it doesn't, it's normally, but it's carefully written to make sure that there's a problem. But really, it doesn't have to do much, but it does have to do something very important, which is dealing with processes that are wards of the state.
Is one like the kernel then?
No. Init is not the kernel. Init is the init executable is the first executable that the kernel runs. Now it turns out init can be a standard shell. In practice it's not, but actually a standard shell does basically all the roles that init has to do. But the big and the key role that init has to deal with, it has to do is deal with wards of the state, which means that orphans. Children who no longer have a living parent. The X processes only have one parent, they do not have multiple parents. But when that parent is gone, init becomes their parent. So what this little pattern should say, there's something important about having a parent. Parents get the process ID of the children. There's some accountability, perhaps? Surely some kind of importance to the parent. So I'll tell you what obligations Unix places on parent processes after we talk about what is the use of a child to a parent. Why do you do this? Why do you create a child? Why did you procreate? Let's say it's a multi-CPU system. Standard processes on Unix are single-threaded. You create another process. Now it can go off and do another computation on another CPU. Doubles your power. Great. But it's more than that. This child process can be used to do things that are potentially unsafe. So, for example, let's say you're going to try parsing some file that's been given to you by an untrusted source. And parsing that file, going through it, interpreting it, who knows what can happen. If you made a mistake or something, it could corrupt your memory, it could cause you to do something unsafe, you don't know. So if you do all of this stuff inside of the main process, you could corrupt yourself. So think of it this way. There's a nuclear power plant that needs, that someone has to control. You've all seen either Star Trek II or Star Trek Into Darkness, right? You know about it? So Kirk or Spock has to go into the reactor to fix the things before these. They have to go into these, you know, central reactor, warp engine, whatever, of the Enterprise, and if it doesn't go in there and fix things, the Enterprise is going to crash into the Earth. The trouble is, whoever goes inside there is going to die. Radiation poisoning, you're dead. Exactly. That is, well, the clone go in there. Because really what we're doing now is making a duplicate. So the Unix solution to the Kobayashi Maru scenario is just to say, make a copy of Kirk or Spock, and let the copy go inside. The clone, identical in every which way. So now, instead of one Kirk, you have two Kirks. One Kirk goes inside, the other one hangs out outside. And then, so instead of tapping on the glass, and you're going like, you know, if you succeed, you know, and you're talking to the other, you know, instead of Kirk coming back and then talking to Spock, or Spock coming back and talking to Kirk, they're talking to themselves. They say, did you do it right? Yes, I did it. Good job. You die now. Sorry. What do you think of my solution? Pretty straightforward. So this is the standard way that Unix deals with unsafe situations. Clone yourself. Do something. Deal with that dangerous input. Do that computation that, you know, operation. Do that thing that might create a divide by zero error. Do something crazy. Tell me how it went. Maybe you'll survive, maybe you're not or something, but, you know, you're going to do your work for a while, and then I'll probably, you know, either you should commit suicide or I'll kill you off or something, you know. Because you can't have too many clones running around. That causes too many problems. But they're useful for periods of time. So why are they called children rather than clones? Well, it's because that their life path does not have to be so short-lived. They can take on new identities. Talk about it a little bit. But then, so the child comes along, they run, they do their thing. But how are they going to tap on the glass? How do they tell the parent process whether they were successful in their mission or not? How do they do it? What? Yes? In part, the idea is that every process has a return value. You know, when you have main and NC function, main has a return value. And return value does not go to you. Yet you return zero or you return something when you exit a C program. Who gets it? Parent process. So when your process exits, which means when your C program terminates, it returns a value. That number goes to the parent process. And the normal thing is when exit zero, exit with a value of zero, everything was fine. Mission accomplished. The exit with a non-zero value, which is kind of bizarre actually, because it's kind of like converting the truth value. But the exit with a non-zero value, that's some sort of error message. Something bad happened. I don't know what. I had some problem. Well, it's up to the implementer how it returns. But the convention is that if you return zero, you did what you were supposed to. If you return non-zero, there is some sort of error. And there has to be some other channel by which the error is propagated. But all you get from the child process is that. Okay. Your order.
So it's only when the child dies that the parent knows?
Yep.
So
it's only when the child dies. Nope. Now you can of course set up ways to talk to the child as it goes off the business. That's a separate thing. It's a separate thing that's optional that depends on the circumstances. The thing that is set in stone that you have to do is know what was the return value of your child. When it died, and what state did it die? Died happy or not? No. So this is called, you have to reap the child. You have to inspect its remains and see what happens. Who does that? Who gets the return value of the child? The parent. Now, if this process is orphaned, then it became a ward of the state, and it doesn't care what the return value is. But it will collect the remains and say, okay, yes, you had an error, too bad. Oh, you didn't have an error, okay. But it doesn't care, but it will deal with it. And this is important. This is important because Unix expects someone to care about the dead. Someone to find out what happened to that process. So what if instead of you, let's say process number four, Let's say process number four, it's got all these children. But let's say it's a neglectful parent. As this one is right here is neglectful, because we have not added any code yet to deal with what happens to children. It doesn't die. It's still running. It's still perfectly fine. It's just ignoring its children. When they die, it's just like, they're dead, whatever. So what happens to children that have not had appropriate burial rights? They turn into zombies. I kid you not. This is the terminology of Unix. Children, child processes that have not had the return value claimed by the parent process become zombies. They are zombies because they are dead. But they are still around and are still taking up resources. They're still kind of there, but they're dead. And in fact, another word for zombies is an unkillable process. It's unkillable because it's already dead. It already shut it. So, I think double tap might be the right solution for getting rid of a zombie, but not Unix. What's the right way to deal with a zombie in Unix? Based on this hierarchy. What? Kill the parent, and kill the zombie. If four is being irresponsible and not taking care of its dead children, kill it. Children become, words of process ID 1 of init, and now they are, init will do its job, claim the zombies, they go away from the process hierarchy. They're now truly dead. Yes. So the way you claim a return value from a dead child process is with the weight, or the weight PID system call. What's the difference between them? Weight PID takes a PID, process ID. Weight does not. So weight will return get the return value of any dead children. While wait PID is looking for the return value of a specific child. So if you're a process that's very prolific, you may want to check whether the return value is a specific process, because that's what wait PID is for. But you just sort of clean it up in general, you just look at wait. So in it, we'll be using wait. Because it doesn't really care. It'll just say, oh, is there a dead child for me to read? Yes, okay. Wait only returns the value of one child. So there's a natural question here, which is, when do you call wait? Well, one thing you could do here is just call, it's not quite the call, but basically, you just call wait in the parent. And what that says is, wait for the child to die. So when will computation continue for the parent? When the child is dead. Not till then. Wait literally means wait. Wait for the child to process. So original Kirk sitting there in front of the reactor, whittling his thumbs, while Kirk clone goes inside there and does the job. He's not doing anything else to try saving the ship or something. He's just whittling his fingers, waiting for him back. And once Kozak says, finished it? Okay, now let me go talk. Now, that's all fine and good, but if that was happening, then, okay, I've created this sacrificial child that at stake that gets corrupted in any way. It's going to die. It won't corrupt the parent. That's all well and good, but this isn't so good if I actually wanted to do some other work while the child is running. If I wanted some kind of parallelism, this isn't very good. So what would be nice is I would like to go on about my business as the parent and then have someone send me a telegram saying my child is dead. And until that happens, I don't want it. I don't care. Till I get that telegram, I just want to do my own thing. You know, this child care stuff. Just be independent. So that means that I have to have some way of receiving a message. So when we talk about signals in Unix, what we're talking about is a very primitive form of process intercommunication, which is designed for sending short messages. Think of them as like little telegrams to tell about important events, such as your child died. Sig child. A specific signal called sig child. Sig child is sent CHLD or CHIL. Right behind it. But anyway, it's a number. That's a small representation. Sig child is sent to the parent process when the child dies. So in order to handle signals, there are signal handlers. So what will happen is the execution of your process will be paused the moment a signal comes in, and instead, and a state will be saved, just kind of like an interrupt, as we'll talk about this. Execution is paused. The signal handler is called. Signal handler then says, what signal did I get? Oh, I got this. Let me go through my mail. You know, here it is. And let me go back. Now, as you might imagine, signals can happen at any point of your computation. So signal handlers should be short, shouldn't mess with system state, and it gets into all kinds of issues of concurrency when you do signal handling. It's it's a miniature version of the problems you get into multi-threaded processes. But for now, all I'm saying is that you're doing your execution, it pauses, you register a signal handler, it will run. When this happens, and the signal handler will take care of running. Maybe wait for PID or something. That came out. So this is the basic architecture of using fork. This is our basic building block of running multiple processes. So we'll do a break here in a second, but just before it, then what I want you to think about is what does executive do, how does executive fit into this problem?
We'll pause there. 5 minutes. Okay, let's
continue. So, fork. So let me show you, before we go on to execd, I have to show you one little bit of code, which is something that you should be very careful about running. While one fork. What does this do? Fork. It keeps forking. It means it keeps creating processes. Processes after processes after processes. Now, if you run this as a regular user, other users can, privileged users such as root can then probably kill off your processes and they all die or something. But this is called a fork bomb. And this is a really good way of ticking off anyone else you're using who's also using the computer. It's much more of an issue when Unix was much more commonly used than both these systems. If you run a fork bomb on the SES Linux systems, you won't make them happy. I actually don't know what sort of, I mean, there are protections you can put in place against fork bombs, but a lot of times Unix systems aren't configured to have them because you don't normally need them. So you might say, well, what happens with this? Well, it turns out there's a finite number of processes that you can create on a system. So if you fork and take up all the process slots, all of a sudden now nobody can create processes. Unix does not do well when no one can create processes. Now, why can root deal with this? Because when you're the super user, you have a certain number of process slots that are reserved for you. Precisely to deal with these kind of situations. So you can create new processes and kill off the bad one. Potentially. Yeah. I'm saying this is known as a denial of service attack. It's not a DOS attack, a local DOS. Not something that will necessarily, won't necessarily corrupt anything, or necessarily mess up any files or something, but it potentially can make a system not very functional. You may want to try this in tutorial and just see what it does to the virtual machine. Virtual machines are a great place to do experiments like this. Although the funny thing is, when you really do these things badly, sometimes you can crash the host OS. Sometimes. Simply because, not because you're supposed to, but simply because sometimes you put so much of a demand on the host operating system that it causes it to die too. Fork fails. I think fork can have an error number. So fork can return a negative value. Right. So actually, you should check the. Good point. Yes, because anytime you make a system calls can fail. And just as I've told you, if you run a fork bomb, if you don't have the resources to do a fork, that fork can fail. That's so. Basic thing, you have to always check the return values that you get. There's always a case where you might get an error. It's a bug. It's something that should not be possible for a guest operating system running a virtual machine to crash. But in practice, there are always those when you really push the resource demands of the virtual machine in weird ways. I wouldn't expect your current implementation of VirtualBox to crash by running a fork bomb in Linux. Possibly. As we'll discuss later in the term, there are a number of compromises that are made in the isolation of the virtual machine. Cost of doing that is potential reduction in security. So, bad way of using fork, good way of using fork. One other way of thinking about how you use fork is, let's say you're getting incoming network requests. Who knows how many network requests you're going to get per second? No. This is not the highest performance design for a network server, but it is probably the simplest, is that you create a child process to handle every incoming request.
So, for example, if you're a web server using this sort of architecture, you fork off a new process every time there's an incoming HTTP request. And that separate process now just talks to that client as it deals with the communication there. And then what happens when another request comes in? You start up another process. Very, very straightforward to code, very relatively secure. Not the most efficient because you're having to create an entire process to handle an incoming request. It all depends on how much work you expect to do for that request, whatever that incoming network request is. If that incoming network request is going to be relatively substantial, then the computational overhead of creating a new process is small relative to that, so you might as well. But if it's computational overhead is going to the amount of computation they do in that request is going to be very small, then it's dominated by the fork. So, wasteful. But let's do something a little more than this. Let's hold exactly. Where does that fit in? Well, you can think of exact VE as a first approximation as one of those dangerous things you want children to do. I.e. commit suicide. Well, not really commit suicide. It's more let someone else take over their body. So that's exactly what happens when you do an exact VE. You take a process and you get rid of all of the memory, all of the state that it had, and you replace it with the state in an executable. You load. You might logically think every time you load an executable off disk and put it into a process, it would always go automatically into a new process. That's the create process way of Windows. That's not the Unix way. The Unix way is you first duplicate the process, and then you call execve in the child. And so by calling execve in the child, you're calling another executable. So every time you type, say, ls at the shell prompt, or every time you double-click on a program and double-click on something in your graphical interface and start up another program, what's actually happening in the background is the program that accepts that incoming input, say, shell where you typed in the command ls, it forks. It creates a duplicate of itself. And the child process then looks at the thing it's supposed to do and says, oh, you want it to run ls. It then runs exact. Runs exact VE and replaces itself with the child, with this new executable. And the parent, which is the original shell, then waits for return about. If you just type ls interactively, the parent process will actually wait. The shell waits until ls returns. That's why you type ls, you then see the listing, and then you get a shell. It's possible to run ls in the background. Run ls in the background, then the shell will not wait for the return value. It will not wait. It will immediately give you a shell prompt, and ls will run. You'll get a shell prompt and then ls will return itself, but overriding the ls that you're doing in the first place. So that's you might say, wait, that's kind of messy. I always want to start a new process when I run executable. Why can't that be combined in a nice call? Unix people would say, no, I already have a perfectly good system call for creating a new process, which is useful on its own under some circumstances. Fork. I don't want to duplicate that functionality. So you get execve, and it's just going to use the same executable. Now, another side benefit of this is that the child process, before calling execve, can do various kinds of setup. can do various kinds of things of setting up its own memory, setting up what files it has access to, setting up its permissions and other things in order to get things ready for the new executable. It's like if you're looking to be possessed by some sort of spirit and you're concerned about what you might do when possessed, you would take precautions. Having yourself tied down in a chair, or locked up in a room. Maybe you gouge out your eyes or something. I don't know. You could do all kinds of things to yourself to make sure that the spirit that possesses you is not able to do too much harm. And that's exactly the kind of things that are done that child processing do before they run executive. They drop privileges. They close open files. They may even, they can isolate themselves in various ways. Or they just do simple setup, like what command line do I have in my environment? So all that computation happens before the executable. And so because all that computation can happen separately, it doesn't have to go in the call. Create process in Windows is relatively complicated because it has to take into account lots of things of how you would want to set up the environment for the new process. Those all become separate calls in Unix because you have another process that's running that will, its environment will be inherited by the executable. So it can do all that for you in separate calls. You don't have to stick it all into one giant. So the key ideas here are which you should feel a little bit kind of like, okay, this is a little bit there, but fork, execve, and those are the big things. And single. Now, I have another 20 minutes. I have two ways. I can either kind of keep trying to clarify this, or there's another piece of this I would like to talk about. But I'm saying that this is Bash. This is Bash running along. You type in ls. What happens is Bash executes a fork. It does a fork system call. That fork system call then does exactly this. The parent process is the main Bash shell. The child one sets up its environment and then does an exec of the ls binary. That's how a shell works. That's what happens when you double click on Firefox. The thing, this is what's happening. Someone did a fork, whatever process that got the input that you want to run another program, and then it did an exec. So it depends on how it's done. If you just type it in without any sort of special, special things, like ls, then Bash will wait for the child to terminate. If you add an ampersand, then you're telling the shell to do it in the background, which means that it returns immediately. Which, in the terms of this, it does the fork, it does the exact VE, but it doesn't do the wait. It just goes on and gives back the prompt. When the LS terminates, there'll be a signal handler that will handle getting the wait. That's what, when we talk about foreground versus background things in the shell, we're just talking about foreground means the shell waits for the child to terminate. Background means the shell doesn't wait. That's all. And as you will see, the
command line in Unix is in many ways a very thin wrapper over system calls. The API really does show through it that you're actually directly manipulating the system in ways that follow this these abstractions. Yes?
How does the operating system know whether a child is playing?
Has the operating system know whether a child is?
When it dies, how does the operating system know whether it's claimed?
So, when a how does the operating system know when a child process is claimed? So when a process terminates, that's the C main function returning zero. So that so you when you return zero, you're, you know, the execution of your process is done. Now the operating system gets that message. So what happens in technical terms is the is an exit system call that is run by the child process. The exit system call tells the kernel, I'm done. Here's my return value. This is all taken care of by the C run. So you get that exit system call that's kind of done in the background. It then goes up. The kernel then says, okay, now this process exited. It's there. Let's put it into, let's put it essentially into the zombie state. Let's record its return value and let's send the signal to the parent process. So the signal set to the parent process, and the parent process has to go, okay, when we call wait PID, wait, it calls the kernel, and the kernel says, here's the return value, I can now deallocate that process structure. I can use that process ID number now for another process.
So the wait function does something explicit that tells the
The wait system call goes to the kernel and says, "Hey, I'm the parent of this of a child. Give me the return value." When it says, "Give me that return value," then the kernel goes, "Okay, here's the return value. I don't have to. I can get rid of that zombie." Normal operation, you never see zombies listed in the process. They actually do. When I say zombie, that's the technical term. You do a process listing, every process is in a different state. Running, sleeping, one of them is Z. So one thing we'll try doing, and we'll actually start, we'll play a bit with these things, and so you can kind of create zombies and see them. So what happens when you don't call wait.
So when you're running it in the background, you're not waiting for it to end.
Exactly. Signal handler. We haven't talked. So signal handlers are more system calls for basically register a system, register a signal handler. The kernel that knows when the signal comes in, I call this. One thing to understand about any program on any system is that there's the code you write that's in your program, and then there's the code that's provided to you by someone else as part of some standard line. So what that means is before your program starts, before main begins, there is code. And when your code exits, when main exits, there is code that runs. You can override this, but there is standard code that happens before main and after main. And one of the things this code before and after does is it takes care of the of talking with the operating system, taking care of setting up things in the process to fit the semantics that your code expects, and bridge that from the semantics of what the operating system gives you. And part of it, and as part of that, there are these various system calls going on. Now, one thing I should probably spend the rest of my time talking about is I'm throwing around this term system call. One thing I have to emphasize is a system call is not a function call. Even though in practice we make most system calls by making function calls. The function call is a wrapper around a system call. But the actual system call is not a function call. So I have to talk about what those two things are. So we're talking about mechanisms here. This is
So part of, when I say system calls are not functions,
I mean, what is a function?
So let's first start with what a function is. So when you call a function, what you're saying is, I want to run this other code. But I want to run this other code with very specific semantics. You say, I'm going to call foo a. I say this function b equals foo of a. This is a function call. I'm calling foo, turning b, I'm giving an argument a. Talking c, what is this thing actually doing? Thing is that somewhere else there is this code. We'll say that B is a bit. There's somewhere around a thing that says int foo. So there is a function somewhere. It's foo. It's declared. It takes an argument. There's the code here. Returns a value. So what happens with execution is we had some code here that was running. Then we got this line here. It goes here, runs this code, and comes back. Start here at this function. Go over here. Run some code. In the context of an address space, what is this? Saying we had some code here. We get code for foo here. We get code for main here. And we were running along in main. And then we jumped here. We executed. And then we jumped back. The main thing is the line in main where we are doing this, we come back to exactly where we were. When this returns, it doesn't go somewhere else. It specifically is here, going there, comes back. How does it know to come right back? Yeah, but how does it? Now, because remember, of course, functions can be nested. I call a function, it may call other functions, and it may call other functions. But yet, when each function returns, it goes back to where it was called, and it goes back from there, and it goes back from there. Yes, because there's a stack. There is a function stack. Which means that, really, over here, there is... Normally, it grows from the top of memory down, somewhere in high memory, the stack. And in that stack, we keep adding values to say, oh, we were here. When we leave main and start running this code, I have to record the address of where I was in main on the stack. I have to push that onto the stack. And then, when foo finishes, I pop that address of where I was running, I put that back in the instruction pointer, and I continue running main. You have to go, you run main, oh, we got to call a function, we push that onto the stack, we go up here, record that, jump to this location, run this code, when it finishes, then we pop it off and jump back here. There are special processor instructions that are designed to facilitate doing this kind of function calls. They're actually built into any assembly language are these kind of calls with specific calling conventions for how you do this and how you also, you don't just push the return value onto the stack, you also push arguments onto the stack. Like, how did you say day over there? It was pushed onto the stack. How do you allocate local variables inside of food? You push them onto the stack. And that way, when you're done, you just pop it all off the stack. You reclaim all that memory. That can be used for the next function call. So the stack is constantly growing and shrinking and growing and shrinking. As you call functions, as your functions are too poorly nested, that's what happens. You know, it just keeps growing. Now, what happens if you start doing recursive functions? The problem with recursive functions is that functions call themselves, they call themselves, call themselves. Stack keeps growing, 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 and if you haven't allocated a large enough stack, you blow out your stack, and program crashes. So that's one trick when you do recursion is you have to limit the depth of your recursion, because the more you recurse, the more stack space you use, and the bigger your stack is. And this is also why you limit the amount of local variables. That all has to be allocated on the stack. Of course, modern systems don't nearly as much of an issue as it used to be, because there's so much memory and all kinds of things on the stack.
Is the size of the stack allocated by
the compiler puts the code in for allocating the stack, and it just keeps growing. And in fact, well, it's the runtime system. Part of it's put in there by the compiler, part of it's in there by libc. Because, of course, you're changing the value of the stack. You're kind of pushing things on there. There's a certain amount of memory that's allocated to your stack. That's a certain part of your address space that has been allocated. If you want to actually have a bigger stack, you actually have to tell the kernel, I want more RAM for it. And you have to tell it to actually extend it. There are system calls to say, give me more memory, allocate more memory, so I can have things like a bigger stack. If you don't do that, then you get error. You get seg fault. So this is, at a high level, what's happening with the function. You're jumping around with addresses, keeping track of where you are in memory by saving the address and then popping it off and returning the address. This is not what happens when you make a system call. It can't be what happens when you make a system. Semantically, system calls feel like functions. Mechanistically, they have to be very different. And that's because the operating system kernel isn't in the same address space. Remember, every process is running in its own address space. It all has its own memory locations. What does it mean to, jump into the kernel? You can't just jump into the kernel. You can't even see its memory. It has its own address space. It has its own variables. It has its own addresses. You can't even refer to it, let alone directly call it. It's not your memory to mess with. Because if you could see the kernel's memory, you could mess with it. That wouldn't be safe. In general, you can't see the kernel's memory. Kernel memory that you can see is that is its value. Now, the other big problem is when you jump around in memory, the processor is in the same state. You aren't changing how much privilege it has. But when you want to make a system call, by its very nature, you want to do something that is privileged. If you want to get more memory or talk to the network or talk to disk or do anything else that the operating system is good for, the reason why you ask the operating system is because it was something your program couldn't do for itself. That was the entire point of talking to the operating system. So you can't do it. Someone else has to do it. That means that you need to switch the computer to a mode where it is possible to do those operations. So you have to do something known as a context. You have to switch from the context of running a user program to the full. Right? Context switch is switching between
process. In one context, you're running process A, in another context, you're running process B, process 5, process 7. That's a context switch. In between these, as part of a context switch, it's known as an up call. Up, as in going into the kernel. So specifically, I need to switch the processor into a privileged mode. When I switch into that privileged mode, then I can do all the special operations. I can access disk directly. I can talk to the network. I have access to all the devices. I have full control of the computer. I can't let every program have full control of the computer. The kernel has full control of the computer. So I have to switch into that mode where I'm running code that has full control of the computer, and then I need to switch back out. Switching back in, switching back out, that's a full context switch. The up call, your up call, you mean up to the privileges of the kernel. The full context switch is when you go into the kernel and then come back out. So this is not a function call. Something weirder. We'll talk. Don't worry if this seems a bit, whoa, what's happening here? We're going to be going over this multiple times, seeing this. But since I'm first talking to you about system calls, talking about fork, talking about all these things, I just want you to know what's behind this curtain, is that there be dragons there, and this is not your regular function stuff. Stop there.